I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take a monumental stack of sources and give you the intellectual shortcut to becoming instantly well-informed. Today, we are strapping ourselves in for an utterly unauthorized descent into the mechanics of the absurd. We are talking about the show that fundamentally broke British comedy and redefined surrealism on television, Monty Python's Flying Circus.
It is, and I mean this, genuinely impossible to overstate the seismic shift this show caused, not just in Britain, but, you know, globally. When you look at the source material we've gathered for this deep dive, you realize pretty quickly it's not just a chronology of sketches. It's a meticulously detailed blueprint for creative rebellion. We have records covering everything, from their university origins, the specific and sometimes bizarre creative contributions of all six Pythons, the agonizing production battles with the BBC, and the whole saga of lost and censored material and their surprisingly difficult, very long path to success in America.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward. We need to find the specific ingredients, you know, the format revolutions they pioneered, the creative friction that made the material so sharp, and the archetypes they perfected. All the things that made the show completely unclassifiable at the time. We want to know exactly how they forced the invention of the adjective Tythonesque just to describe what they were doing, because, well, no existing word would suffice.
Precisely. We are diving past the easy-to-quote catchphrases and really getting into the structural integrity, or maybe the deliberate lack of it, the madness. We're analyzing the creative machinery that made anarchic comedy commercially viable.
Okay, let's unpack this genesis. By 1969, the six main cast members, Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, Michael Palin, and Terry Gilliam, they weren't novices. They were already key players in the British comedy establishment, but they were all operating in these distinct smaller groups.
And that's the absolutely crucial prequel moment. They had all met and, you know, sharpened their teeth through the major university comedy circuits. Chapman, Cleese, and Idle were famously part of the Cambridge Footlights.
Right, the Footlights.
And then Jones and Palin were part of the Oxford Review. By the mid-60s, these two factions were collaborating pretty extensively on major TV and radio projects. Shows like The Frost Report, which gave them experience in sharp political satire, and at last, the 1948 show, which is where they really started playing with sketch structure. Gilliam, the American, he came over and met the Cambridge crew while he was on tour.
So when they pitched this new project, they weren't exactly finding a voice from scratch. They were trying to blend their existing successful comedic styles, satire, wordplay, character work into a single chaotic, high-energy thing.
Exactly. And the genre they birthed reflects that hybrid origin. Officially, the show is classified as sketch comedy, surreal humor, satire, and black comedy. But the real revolution, as you said, wasn't just the content. It was the delivery mechanism, the anti-sketch show format.
We talk about the anti-sketch format, and our source material specifically points to the intentional discarding of the traditional sketch structure. Most sketch comedy demanded a setup, a clear development, a climax, and crucially, a clear punchline, followed by a blackout. Python just refused to play that game.
They intentionally and defiantly discarded that expectation. They created these absurd situations and observational sketches without punchlines. Their goal was to make the humor feel like an uninterrupted stream of consciousness, or maybe a nervous breakdown played out on television. In doing this, they were following and, importantly, elaborating upon the style that Spike Milligan had already used in his groundbreaking series, Q.
Let's pause on Spike Milligan for a moment, because that comparison is vital for understanding Python's innovation. How did Python take what Milligan started and push it into a completely new territory?
Well, Milligan's Q series was revolutionary because it was the first to openly defy sketch continuity. He would just end sketches abruptly or have actors break character. It was genuinely anarchic.
Pure chaos.
But Python formalized that anarchy. They didn't just let the sketch die. They invented these mechanisms, the Gilliam animations, the Colonel, the announcer, to violently destroy the narrative. They made the destruction of the sketch the punchline itself. Milligan broke the rules. Python rewrote the rulebook by making the lack of resolution their signature, sustained style.
That structural defiance is the core of their genius. But we can't ignore the superficial absurdity. Before we dive into the mechanics, we have to talk about the name. Monty Python's Flying Circus. It sounds like something a child would invent. Yet it's filled with these internal contradictions. How on earth did they land on that peculiar title?
It was a perfect storm of bureaucratic fiat and just intentional silliness. The source material breaks down the title perfectly, showing how this name, which is now so iconic, was essentially constructed by committee and outside forces.
Okay, we had to start with circus. Where did that come from?
That was a mandate from the BBC's head of comedy, a man named Michael Mills. Mills insisted on circus. And the reason was simple. The six members were known for wandering around the BBC building, disorganized, prone to intense arguments, and generally chaotic. The BBC staff had already nicknamed them Baron von Tuck's Circus after Barry Tuck, the producer who first brought them into the organization.
So the name was literally forced upon them because the Pythons were too anarchic to manage.
That's it. Within the standard BBC structure, they were a circus.
That's fantastic. The corporation essentially labeled them for their chaos, but then they added flying to confuse things even more.
They added flying to make the name sound less like an actual, you know, a tangible three-ring circus and more like a high-octane dangerous endeavor. And this addition had a distinct cultural tie-in. The song Snoopy versus the Red Baron was incredibly popular at the time.
Oh, right.
It referenced the World War I German fighter squadron led by Manfred von Richthofen, which was known as the Flying Circus. It gave the show's underlying absurdity a slightly historical, militaristic edge that contrasted beautifully with all the domestic comedy elements.
So we have the BBC's bureaucratic nickname mixed with a World War I fighter squadron reference. Now for the completely invented part. Monty Python.
Right. Cleese and Idle are credited with crooning this half of the title. They wanted the full name to sound like a really bad theatrical agent. You know, the kind of person who would be responsible for putting this specific deranged group together. Cleese suggested Python because it sounded slimy and slithery, evoking something untrustworthy. Idle suggested Monty, which they found hilarious because it immediately referenced Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery.
Lord Montgomery, the great, respectable general of the Second World War. The result is a slimy agent's name slapped onto a respected WWII general attached to a WWII fighter squadron given to them by the BBC's nickname for their writers. The layers of conflicting high-low culture absurdity are woven right into the show's DNA before the first sketch even airs.
And the fact they secured this title is even more ludicrous when you look at the titles the BBC rejected. It shows the sheer, unfiltered creative state they were in when they were pitching.
The alternatives are a deep dive into the Python subconscious. I want to know what kind of meetings they were having.
The list is just astonishing. They rejected Wither Canada, which sounds like a profoundly earnest but boring documentary. The No-Show, Ow, It's Colin Flint, A Horse, A Spoon, and A Basin, The Toad Elevating Moment, and The Magnificent Owl Stretching Time.
Owl Stretching Time. I feel like that name alone encapsulates their specific brand of pointlessness. What does that particular rejected title tell us about the creative process?
Yeah.
That they were willing to pitch something that sounds like a rural hobby for the clinically insane?
It tells us two things. First, they were entirely focused on avoiding generic titles that suggested traditional sketch comedy. And second, and more importantly, it shows their confidence in the material itself. They knew the content was so unique it could support a title like The Toad Elevating Moment or Owl Stretching Time. They were signaling, abandon all expectations of traditional structure or content before you even tune in.
And they even recycled some of these for episode names, right?
They did. Several of these rejected titles were later used for individual episode names, proving that while they lost the battle for the overall title, they considered no piece of absurdity too sacred to discard.
So to sustain this idea of the stream of consciousness of a show with intentional on structure, they had to invent their own new internalized structural devices. This is where the mechanics of the madness truly emerge across the show's 45 episodes.
And this is where Terry Gilliam's influence moves from tangential to, well, absolutely fundamental. His animations weren't just filler or visual gags. They were the essential narrative glue that allowed the Pythons to violate continuity with impunity.
He was the visual bridge. His cutout animations actively linked live-action segments, often merging with them to form segues and tangents that would be impossible to produce live. It was the ultimate cheat code for the anti-sketch show.
Absolutely. If a sketch wasn't working, or if it had achieved maximum absurdity and didn't need a punchline, they didn't need a fade to black, Gilliam could simply have a cartoon foot crush the set, or have the characters merge into a hideous Victorian machine, pulling the viewer violently into the next unrelated scene. It was a visual way to say, we're done here, move along.
And his style is so iconic. It's characterized by those sudden dramatic movements, the deliberate mismatches of scale, and those grotesque Victorian gadgets set in surrealist, often apocalyptic landscapes.
Yeah.
Where did he find the raw material for this visual chaos?
The source material is quite specific on this. He primarily used cutouts from 19th century art, particularly engravings of buildings and machinery, often from old books or magazines. And rather famously, the people were often cut from old Sears Roebuck catalogs. He would combine these diverse, incongruous elements. A highly respectable Victorian gentleman's head on a tiny running body, for instance, to create new, humorous, often deeply unsettling meanings. He was initially only hired as the animator, but his work quickly became indispensable to the show's entire rhythm, defining the visual identity of the entire circus.
And the opening credits feature arguably the most iconic single image of the entire troupe. That giant foot crushing the show's title. Where did that come from? It's high art appropriation at its finest.
That foot, which became known affectionately as the Foot of Cupid, was appropriated directly by Gilliam from the figure of Cupid in the Agnolo Bronzino painting Venus, Cupid, Folly, and Time, a famous Mannerist work.
Wow.
Gilliam literally took a piece of respected Renaissance high art, isolated the foot, and used it to metaphorically squash the title of their lowbrow revolutionary show in every single opening sequence. It's the perfect symbol for Python's mission, defacing high culture with lowbrow slapstick and intentional vandalism.
Before the foot came down, we were always greeted by the theme song, John Philip Sousa's The Liberty Bell March. We are talking about a show rooted in creative anarchy. So was this dramatic, very American 1890s military march a deliberate artistic choice?
It was actually a very pragmatic choice with a brilliant outcome. Gilliam selected that 1893 march because, under the Berne Convention and U.S. copyright law, it was in the public domain. It could be used royalty-free.
Ah, so it was cheap.
Exactly. They avoided paying any licensing fees to the original rights holders. So even their majestic, iconic anthem of anarchy and creative freedom was fundamentally based on avoiding a royalty payment. It is a fantastic detail that perfectly sums up their working mentality.
Brilliant. Now let's talk about the human linking devices, the recurring figures who physically ushered us into the chaos when Gilliam's animation wasn't enough. The BBC announcer, usually John Cleese.
Yes. Cleese, leveraging his height and imposing presence, would appear, often dressed impeccably in a tuxedo, but placed in wildly incongruous locations on a beach, emerging from a dense forest, or dangling from a cliff. He would introduce the segment with the famous phrase, "And now for something completely different." This phrase, which became the title for their first film, acted as a formal announcement that all narrative structure had been abandoned, and we were pivoting to pure non sequitur.
I always associate that line with Cleese, but the forces point out an interesting wrinkle about who first delivered it.
Yes, that's right. While Cleese became the signature deliverer, Eric Idle actually introduced the phrase first in episode 2. By series 3, that line was often shortened to just, "And now?" Or even simply a visual nod, because the audience knew that the very act of an introduction meant an arbitrary break in content was coming.
And then you have the It's Man, Michael Palin, who acts as the ultimate non sequitur before the show even begins.
Michael Palin played the It's Man, a Robinson Crusoe-type figure with torn clothes and a long beard. The joke relies entirely on anticipation and frustration. He would undertake some incredibly long or dangerous task, running across a vast plain, falling off a jagged cliff, or surviving an explosion, and then rush toward the camera saying only, "It's," before being abruptly cut off by the opening titles and the smashing foot.
That's it.
That's it. This character was so pivotal in signaling the show's tone of abruptness that It's was an early candidate for the title of the series itself.
Moving beyond the links, the show is famously characterized by recurring archetypes rather than characters with continuous storylines. This is another crucial anti-sketch innovation.
Exactly. The source notes that sketch continuity was often non-existent. They simply didn't care about it. But certain types of people recurred consistently, defining specific comedic tropes the Pythons wished to lampoon.
Let's start with the Gumbies.
Yeah.
They embody a specific type of English cultural idiocy.
The Gumbies, most associated with Michael Palin, were the quintessential, dim-witted, identically attired people. Their uniform is a meticulous stereotype of the lower middle class English working class holidaymaker. Gumboots, high-water trousers held up by braces, white shirts with rolled-up sleeves, and a knotted handkerchief worn on their heads to prevent sunstroke.
I can picture it perfectly.
They stood in a distinctive hunched posture, speaking slowly in loud, throaty, monosyllabic voices punctuated by frequent grunts of "ee." They were the physical embodiment of unthinking, anti-intellectual aggression, often performing bizarre rituals like trying to lift pianos with their heads.
They are pointless and abrasive. And then the pepper pots, their term for the middle-aged housewives.
The pepper pots was the Python's in-house term for their screeching, middle-aged, lower-middle-class housewives, played by the men in simple frocks and frumpy hats. Cleese explained that pepper pot referred to the Python's belief in the typical rounded body shape of these suburban housewives. Terry Jones, in particular, was renowned for his rat bag woman roles, creating the shriller, more disheveled drag characters. But all the men participated in portraying this specific, highly critical view of Middle England.
We must address the interrupters, the meta-commentary characters who physically stop the sketch because it has become too serious or too silly.
You have three crucial interrupters. First, the Colonel, played by Graham Chapman, the quintessential British Army officer who would interrupt sketches for being too silly or sometimes, conversely, too offensive. His function was to destroy the narrative from within by applying arbitrary institutional authority.
Right.
Second, the knight with a raw chicken, usually played by Gilliam, who would interrupt sketches by running in and hitting characters over the head with the chicken when they uttered something he deemed silly.
And then the ultimate example of the unexpected interruption, the Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition is the ultimate Python catchphrase because it perfectly codifies the non sequitur. This troop, Cardinal Ximenez Palin, Cardinal Fang Gilliam, and Cardinal Biggles Jones, would burst into previously unrelated sketches whenever their name was merely mentioned, premiering in Series 2. It's not just a joke, it's a narrative device. It demonstrates that any word, phrase, or suggestion can trigger a total violent change in reality. That randomness is the defining structural mechanism of the entire show.
The brilliance of the six pythons lies in how they operated as a creative machine. Despite the shared pool of roles, like the necessity for all of them to play women, each member had specialized character types and, crucially, specialized writing dynamics that fueled the engine of the show.
Their synergy was rooted in how they paired off to write. You had the intense, structured collaboration of Cleese and Chapman, contrasted with the more observational, atmospheric, character-driven work of Jones and Palin. Eric Idle was the third way, the solitary writer focused on monologue and wordplay. Analyzing these dynamics really reveals their individual genius within the group context.
Let's start with the Cleese Chapman dynamic, focusing on Graham Chapman first, the maniacal straight man.
Chapman often played the stoic authority figures, the military officers, doctors, or judges, who provided a sober, dignified face of the establishment. But his specialty, which defined his performance in classics like the Argument Clinic and Dead Parrot, was his ability to flip instantly from perfect dignity to full-blown, often abusive, Python-esque, maniacal behavior.
That sudden switch.
Exactly. He was the master of the explosive, brusque delivery of abuse, often against a bewildered Michael Palin. His sobriety provided the necessary street man foil for the surrounding madness, which is why he was so essential as King Arthur and Holy Grail.
And John Cleese, the physical and intimidating authority figure who often specialized in figures under siege?
Cleese, standing a formidable 6 feet 5 inches tall, used his physicality to great effect. He typically played characters that were either the source of ridiculous authority, like the instructor in the self-defense against fresh fruit sketch, or characters who were desperately trying to maintain decorum while the world collapsed around them. His intense verbal delivery was his weapon of choice.
His most recognizable use of that physicality has to be the Ministry of Silly Walks.
Indeed, it's the definitive visual sketch showcasing his long, loose-limbed movements. But here is the critical analytical detail from the source material. Cleese reportedly disliked that sketch.
Really?
He felt the laughs it generated were cheap and lacked the true satirical center he preferred. He was always pushing for the intellectual edge, the linguistic absurdity, like the famous complaints of Mr. Eric Praline.
What is that rejection of silly walks in their most commercially successful visual piece? Tell us about Cleese's priorities.
It tells us that for Cleese, the core of Python had to be satirical and based on institutional reconstruction, not just physical humor. He wanted the audience to laugh at the ridiculousness of bureaucracy, not just a funny walk. This preference for intellectual comedy over slapstick created natural friction with the other members, which ultimately contributed to him leaving after Series 3.
But that friction is what made it work.
That friction, however, is what made the show brilliant. The constant push and pull between the cerebral and the utterly infantile.
Speaking of Mr. Eric Praline, the disgruntled consumer.
Yes, Praline, often wearing his characteristic pack-a-mac, is the quintessential put-upon English consumer featured in two of the most popular consumer sketches, Dead Parrot and the Fish License sketch. He embodies the high-energy, frustrated victim essential to Cleese's writing style. And on a visual note, Terry Gilliam claimed that Cleese was actually the funniest in drag due to his massive size and distinctively square chin, making the absurdity of the costume even greater.
Moving to the visual engine. Terry Gilliam. The visual and grotesque.
Gilliam was initially hired for animation only. His on-screen appearances were infrequent and usually reserved for roles no one else wanted. The heavy makeup, the most uncomfortable costumes, or parts requiring extreme physical grossness. He became distinguished as the go-to member for the most obscenely grotesque characters.
He's the one who could be safely covered in food or wear a stoat on his head.
Precisely. He was the knight who hits people with a chicken, cardinal fang, or, most notoriously, the fat, appallingly flatulent young man obsessed with and often covered in baked beans in the most awful Family in Britain sketch. He was the physical embodiment of the gross, anarchic tangents his animation allowed, a necessary counterpoint to the more mannered acting of Cleese and Chapman.
Eric Idle, the solitary writer and the master of the wordy monologue.
Idle was the master of the extended one-liner, the cheekiness, and the linguistic spiral. He often played suggestive playboys, nudge-nudge, slick salesmen, or pretentious TV presenters, all roles requiring extensive, fast-paced dialogue. Importantly, he was the only Python who typically wrote his sketches alone prior to the show, while the others worked in pairs. This gave his material a unique, slightly more meta or observational edge compared to the confrontational style of Cleese Chapman.
And he was the group's key musical talent.
He was the group's best singer and songwriter, responsible for many classic tracks, most famously, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. When he played women, he often did so in a more straightforward manner, only altering his voice slightly, avoiding the high-pitched falsetto shrieking used by Jones and Palin.
This brings us to the second major writing pair, Terry Johns and Michael Palin. They were known for creating atmosphere and surreal character types rather than confrontation.
That's the key distinction. Jones and Palin focused on observation and finding the absurdity in mundane settings, like tea shops or suburban living. Terry Johns, as we noted, was the expert in the female ratbag role. His drag characters were louder, shriller, and more disheveled, such as Mandy, Brian's mother in Life of Brian. He also played the iconic nude organist who introduced all of Series 3, often wearing nothing but a tie and a white shirt collar, a perfect blend of formal wear and absurdity.
And behind the scenes, Johns' role was far more significant than his on-screen appearances might suggest.
Crucially, yes. While he often deferred as a performer, Johns proved himself behind the scenes, eventually pulling most of the strings for the troupe's directorial efforts. He became the sole director for Life of Brian and The Meaning of Life, providing the focused vision necessary to translate their sketch chaos into feature film narrative.
Finally, Michael Palin, the wide-ranging chameleon who specialized in The Sympathetic Fool and The Shopkeepers.
Palin was universally regarded as having the widest range. He could play the straight man perfectly, like the hapless client in the argument clinic, the working-class northerner in sketches like Every Sperm is Sacred, or wildly over-the-top high-energy maniacs like Cardinal Ximenez. His most famous creation, however, was the disreputable shopkeeper who attempts to sell useless goods with weak attempts at craftiness, seen in Dead Parrot and The Cheese Shop.
Right, the shopkeeper.
He often grounded these characters with relatable accents, particularly Cockney or Northern dialects, which made the surrounding absurdism land even harder.
So if we synthesize this, the ecosystem was incredibly complex. We had the confrontational, cerebral authority figures of Cleese and Chapman, the gentle atmospheric surrealism and strong character work of Johns and Palin, the meta-commentary and wordplay of Idle, and the pure, physical, grotesque, visual anarchy of Gilliam. They were a perfectly designed creative unit built entirely on complementary friction.
Now we move to the institutional friction. The common wisdom is that Python was an instant revolutionary hit, but the source material confirms the beginning was not only commercially hostile, but institutionally despised.
The initial reception in the UK was shockingly poor. The first episode premiered on the 5th of October, 1969, at extremely low audience figures. only about 3% of the UK population tuned in, roughly 1.5 million viewers. That's a tiny slice of the pie.
And that wasn't even the worst metric. We needed to find the Appreciation Index, or AI. This was a specific BBC metric measuring viewer satisfaction, or quality and enjoyment, as opposed to mere viewership numbers.
Ah.
Python's first episode earned the lowest appreciation index of any of the BBC's light entertainment programs that week. This confirms that the establishment viewers and critics who did watch it actively disliked the content. BBC executives quickly developed an intense dislike, with internal documents describing the show as disgusting and nihilistic.
That initial failure, or rather the initial incomprehension, must have been incredibly motivating for the troupe. The BBC hated it, the audience wasn't watching, so they must have felt vindicated in their decision to break all the rules.
It absolutely fueled their fire to push boundaries further, but that hostility quickly translated into direct censorship and strained relations with their producer. One of the earliest instances was surprisingly petty. The Pythons included the real personal address and phone number for David Frost, which forced the BBC to re-edit several first series episodes to remove this information after viewers began bothering him relentlessly.
But the tensions really peaked after series two when they hit two major institutional nerves.
Yes, specifically after Royal Episode 13 in December 1970. Executives were deeply offended by two segments. First, the mockery of the national anthem in "The Queen Will Be Watching," which was deemed disrespectful to the monarchy. Second, the now infamous Undertaker sketch, which contained references to necrocannibalism, specifically the line, "Are you suggesting we should eat my dead mother?" The BBC criticized the producer for not alerting them to the content, and this incident led directly to increased internal censorship during Series 3.
Given the BBC's internal documents call the show nihilistic, was the issue truly the necro-cannibalism, or was the BBC using that specific line as a justifiable public excuse to attack the Pythons' overall anarchic and anti-establishment tone?
The sources strongly suggest the latter. The BBC establishment couldn't articulate why they hated the structure or the tone, which defied categorization, so they focused on specific moral violations like necro-cannibalism. This provided a concrete reason to exert control. This professional strain contributed directly to the first big change in the lineup.
John Cleese left after Series 3. What were the specific factors that led to his departure?
His cited reasons were multifaceted. Firstly, he felt genuine creative fatigue. He felt the material was becoming rehashes of prior skits and the ideas were growing thin. Secondly, and perhaps more personally, he found the collaboration increasingly difficult, particularly working with Graham Chapman, who was struggling profoundly with severe alcoholism at the time. Cleese, who preferred control and structure, found the increasing chaos unsustainable. The remaining five Pythons attempted to carry on, producing a shortened series 4 of only 6 episodes before ending the show entirely in December 1974.
One of the most fascinating parts of this entire deep dive is the history of the lost and censored material. Because the BBC was so hostile, they were always cutting things, leading to years of confusion over what the original broadcast actually was.
The list of cuts is detailed and illuminating. For example, language cuts included muting or cutting the word masturbating from the summarized Prowse sketch. More controversially, the BBC cut "What a Silly Bunt," a joke based on a character's speech impediment in the travel agent sketch, before it ever aired.
So it never even made it to broadcast.
No. However, the importance of secondary sources is clear here. That specific offensive line was preserved on the audio album Monty Python's previous record, showing how their work bypassed TV censorship through other media.
And there was also institutional censorship regarding sensitive topics like illness, which they handled arbitrarily.
References to cancer were censored twice during Series 2. Once in a Gilliam cartoon where the word cancer was dubbed over with gangrene to make it less offensive.
Wow.
And again in the Conquistador cocky campaign sketch. This highlights the BBC's hypersensitivity, yet strangely, a reference to leprosy remained entirely intact in the same episode, demonstrating the arbitrary nature of the institutional standards they were fighting against.
The ultimate lost sketch was the Undertaker sketch, which was removed from repeat broadcasts entirely.
That sketch's saga is the clearest example of the BBC trying to erase offending material. It was pulled due to the backlash over the necro-cannibalism joke. Fortunately, it was later restored from an NTSC copy that had been duplicated before the cut was made. This points directly to the incredible importance of home recordings, especially those made in the US, in preserving the Pythons' original uncut work.
So how were these completely lost sketches recovered in general?
They were recovered almost exclusively thanks to avid fan recordings made by viewers of U.S. PBS broadcasts. For instance, the party political broadcast choreographed sketch, which was genuinely thought lost forever, was eventually found on a home-recorded tape from a Buffalo, New York PBS outlet.
WNED-TV.
That's the one. And it surfaced on YouTube in 2008. The show's subsequent 50th anniversary Blu-ray restoration sought to reinstate all material to the original uncut broadcast length, including even more obscure material like the West Side Story parody from the bus conductor sketch.
The irony is rich. If American fans hadn't been avidly taping these broadcasts of a show that the BBC despised, a significant portion of the Python's original uncut, structurally anarchic work might have been lost forever.
The story of Python's launch across the Atlantic is marked by rejection, failure, and then a massive grassroots surge that eventually forced the U.S. networks to comply with the Python's artistic standards.
I always assumed that if they were a hit in the U.K., even a controversial one, they would have been an instant cult success in the U.S. But the initial failure in America was striking.
It was a disaster. Time Life Television, which was responsible for distributing BBC shows in the U.S., initially refused to pick up Monty Python. They categorically believed the humor was too British for mass U.S. audiences, relying too heavily on British institutional satire and highbrow, lowbrow linguistic jokes that wouldn't translate.
Right.
Furthermore, the first film, and now for something completely different, also failed completely to gain traction in American theaters upon its initial limited release.
And their early attempts at performing on U.S. television were apparently even more catastrophic than the initial low ratings in the U.K.
Catastrophic is the right word. During their first North American tour in 1973, they performed on The Tonight Show, which was hosted by Joey Bishop at the time. Eric Idle described the experience in the sources. "We did 30 minutes of material in 15 minutes to no laughs whatsoever. The audience was silent. Total silence." He said, "We ran out onto the green grass in Burbank, and we lay down and laughed for 15 minutes because it was the funniest thing ever. In America, they didn't know what on earth we were talking about. They were simply too far ahead of the curve for the mainstream U.S. audience."
So if major distributors rejected them and live audiences didn't understand the tone, how did they crack the U.S. market at all?
The sources point squarely to the PBS lifeline. The show first gained popularity in Canada starting in 1970, which allowed some U.S. border markets to see it. But the real American breakthrough began in 1974 when Kira, a PBS member station in Dallas, Texas, was the first U.S. station to broadcast episodes consistently.
It was a public station relying on viewer donations that launched a comedy revolution.
Exactly. The success spread rapidly among PBS stations, driven purely by word of mouth and counterculture enthusiasm. By 1975, Monty Python's Flying Circus was often the most popular show on these public stations. This unexpected popularity forced the successful re-release of their first film, and critically, it set the stage for the massive success of Monty Python and the Holy Grail in 1975.
So PBS was their launchpad.
It was not just a launchpad for Python. It opened the door for many other innovative, often more niche British series to enter the U.S. market.
But the U.S. commercial networks, seeing the success, eventually came calling, which led to the famous pivotal legal battle for artistic control.
In mid-1975, the ABC network acquired the rights to show select episodes of the series. However, ABC did what broadcasters always do with unconventional programming. They aggressively re-edited the episodes, they had to cut time for commercials, but they also systematically destroyed the flow and continuity the Pythons had designed by eliminating the Gilliam animations and all the famous non-sequiturs that linked the sketches.
They were trying to force Python into the very traditional sketch show format the BBC had wanted in 1969.
They were eliminating the structural anarchy that defined the show, and the Pythons took them to court over this creative violation.
As they should have.
They sued ABC immediately for copyright violation and destruction of artistic integrity. While the initial court refused to halt the broadcasts, fearing prior restraint, the Pythons ultimately won on appeal. This victory was monumental for artists everywhere. They gained control over all subsequent U.S. broadcasts of their work.
So their biggest legal victory wasn't about money. It was about protecting the integrity of the absurd structure they had invented.
It was entirely about creative control, protecting the stream of consciousness format and the deliberate linking devices they had pioneered. They successfully argued that by cutting the non sequiturs, ABC had changed the meaning and intent of the work. If ABC had succeeded,
it would have been a different show.
Completely. The fundamental mechanism of Python would have been destroyed, and the resulting show would have been unrecognizable. This legal success eventually allowed them to gain control of the master tapes from the BBC in 1980 after their original contracts expired.
The legacy of this show, beyond the legal precedent, is embedded in pop culture in often surprising, highly technical places.
Absolutely. Two famous cultural footprints derived directly from the series are so common that people often forget their origin. First, the word spam for junk email is derived from the famous spam sketch, where nearly every item on the menu is replaced by the canned meat.
Of course.
Second, the creator of the widely used computer language, Guido Van Rossum, named the Python programming language directly after the show because he was a massive fan and wanted a name that reflected fun and approachability.
And critically, the show's lasting quality is recognized by the industry itself, moving far beyond that initial low appreciation index.
The accolades are impressive and enduring. The show was ranked fifth on the BFI TV 100 list in 2000, and Time magazine included it in its 100 best TV shows of all time in 2007. Five key sketches were ranked in Channel 4's 50 Greatest British Sketches in 2005, with Dead Parrot placing at number 2 and the Spanish Inquisition at number 12. And the show's influence is acknowledged universally, most famously by Lorne Michaels, who cites Python as a major influence and structural template for Saturday Night Live.
So we went from a show that the BBC thought was disgusting and nihilistic, garnering the lowest audience satisfaction index of the week, to a global cultural phenomenon whose creator successfully sued a massive U.S. network, not for money, but to protect the integrity of their structural anarchy. Hashtag tag outro. It's an incredible journey. From six university chums blending their disparate comedy styles, inventing the anti-sketch show format, using royalty-free music and appropriated high art for their visuals, to defining an entire comedic genre entirely on their own terms. The core of the Python-esque style, as we've seen, was always the deliberate structural anarchy, the rejection of the punchline, the interruption by the kernel, the surreal Gilliam animations that acted as a bridge between everything and nothing.
And we've learned that the structure was so important, they fought a major legal battle against ABC simply to prevent their material from being re-edited into a conventional format that would have destroyed the stream of consciousness flow. They succeeded by breaking every single rule of television comedy. The ultimate legacy isn't just the content of Dead Parrot or Silly Walks, but the legal precedent they established. The artist's right to control the integrity of their edited work. They proved that artistic structure itself is worth fighting for.
That brings us to our final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. If Monty Python's Flying Circus had been forced to maintain the traditional sketch show format the BBC initially preferred, sticking to punchlines and continuity, or if they had lost that pivotal legal battle against re-editing in the U.S., allowing their work to be mutilated for commercial breaks, would the word Python-esque even exist today to describe boundary-pushing comedy? What does their lifelong successful fight for creative control teach us about the value of protecting artistic structure over popular accessibility?